Studies here at Oxford College, and on behalf of President Paul Privenow and Dean Barbara Farley, I'd like to welcome you to our fine school. I'd like to welcome many people who have come from the cities, our alums who've come back, our students who are here, our friends from Carleton College who've traveled far to be with us. And we welcome you all this evening. We should thank the musicians here. This group is called... They've also been practicing for a week, but you wouldn't know it. I mean, they just learned these songs for a week. That's what I mean. I meant that as a nice one. It sounds really good. The name of their group is Magni Laetai Femini, which I believe means loud, happy women. And it certainly does. Terry Jones is going to come out in just a second and talk for 4 to 5 hours. About 45 minutes. So, I would like to introduce our speaker, certainly a man who needs no introduction. But let me just say that some of you probably have come because of a group called Monty Python. And I'm sure that you all know about that, but what you might not know, unless you've read the program notes, is that Terry is quite an accomplished medievalist and medieval scholar and gives presentations in Britain and in Europe and in the United States. He's on a brief tour to many universities, and we're the only place in Minnesota and perhaps in the Midwest where he's stopping for a performance. So we're very grateful that he is here, and I'll let you read the program notes because I don't want to take up his time. Terry Jones.
You see, it's such a wonderful lot. I mean, wasn't the choir great, were they? Okay. 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 Actually, you all got it before I got it. I thought, I recognise that too. It's only when they start doing that, that's what they were doing. Well, the talk I'm going to give tonight came out of a TV series I did about 5 years ago called Medieval Lives. The talk isn't really, it doesn't repeat the programmes, actually, so if you've seen the programmes, don't worry. The talk's more about kind of the kind of misconceptions we all have about when we think about the Middle Ages. So we need to sort of put the lights down a bit, because it's all on the screen, can you see it properly? Nicholas! Okay, enough of that. I guess when we start thinking about the Middle Ages, we kind of think about fairy tale, people living in fairy tale castles. We think of knights in armour riding around on horses with beautiful damsels in distress. But it's also a time of great danger, a time of great cruelty, a time when there was bloodshed and warfare throughout the world. It was also, of course, a time of darkness, of ignorance and superstition. A time when people thought that the earth was flat and perhaps, you know, supported by four elephants on a tortoise. Now, the weirdest thing is that in the Middle Ages, people didn't think the world was flat. I mean, it came as a surprise to me when I actually learned that. And yet, people said, well, the world is round. I mean, Nicholas Oresme, I never know quite how to pronounce his name. How do you pronounce it, Phil? Oresme, yeah, I suspected that was it. Well, he said that the world is round like a ball. Geoffrey Chaucer says that this world, which that men say is round, I would give, I'm a lord of it. And actually, they knew the size of it too. Roger Bacon in the 13th century said the curvature of the earth explains why we can see higher, further from higher up. Because when you're higher up, you can see further around the curve. So they knew perfectly well, I mean, they'd known since Greek times that the world was round. There's even pictures of the round world. Here we've got Christ holding up a... It's not a cricket ball, it's actually a... it's actually the world. So the question is, why do we think that they thought the world was flat in the Middle Ages? Well, I'm afraid the culprit, the person was one main person responsible, and I'm afraid he's one of your countrymen. His name was Washington Irving, and you probably know him as the writer of Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle. He also actually wrote a biography of Muhammad as well. That's why many people know that. Anyway, in 1828, Washington Irving published a biography of Christopher Columbus. And in this biography of Christopher Columbus, he described a very dramatic scene where Columbus confronted the church fathers at Salamanca. And the church fathers got very angry with him and accused him of heresy for saying that the world was round when the church taught that the world was flat. Now, Washington Irving just made this up. The church never taught that the world was flat. It certainly wasn't heresy to say it was round. But Washington Irving thought it made rather a good story, so he put it into his book. And it might have just stayed in the book, except for some very venerable people. The Darwinists, the Darwinians, they picked up on this idea that people in the Middle Ages thought the world was flat. And whenever anybody sort of countered their arguments about evolution, they said, oh, you were just like people in the Middle Ages who thought the world was flat. So the Darwinians actually spread this idea in perpetrating their own concepts, their own truths. And actually, there's a wonderful book called Inventing the Flat Earth, which I urge you to read, which actually tells the story of how we believe that the people in the Middle Ages thought the world was flat. Why were their maps so bad? I mean, this is a map of the world from 1109. And as you see, it's not much to write home about. There's Albania up there, France, Germany, Africa here, India here, and of course paradise in the middle. this is another map of the world. This is what's called a T&O map of the world. And you can see there's Asia there, Europe here, and Africa here. Of course, the thing is that these weren't really maps in our sense of the world. They were just aid memoirs. They were just a shorthand way of remembering things. At a time when you didn't have printed books, you had to have ways of remembering things. And this is just a visual aid to help you remember the continents and remember also the size of them, and the relative size of them as well. A map in the Middle Ages, these are mappa mundis, these things were called, mapper meant tablecloth. And these really cloths, they were diagrams, they were histories of the world. They weren't just showing you your geographical position on the world. In fact, they weren't showing you that at all. They were more sort of like talking pieces. In this one here, you've got the Adam and Eve up there at the beginning. You've got the Red Sea here. You've got Jerusalem in the middle, of course, and Rome just down there. In fact, they did have maps if they needed maps. They could do these sort of these maps like this. These sort of itineraries by Matthew Paris from about 12th century. And you can see in this itinerary, it starts here at London. That's St Paul's, because in those days St Paul's had a spire. And then you go each place here. It says here a journée. Of course, journée is a day. It's French for a day. So that's how we get the word journey. And it's a journée to Rochester, from London to Rochester, a journée from Rochester to Canterbury, and then a journée to Dover, and there's the sea. And then you come down here again, there's the sea again, and you're in France, and you do a journée on the way through, and so on, to Jerusalem. They were itineraries. So the basic thing about finding a way around in the Middle Ages, there was no point in having a map like we have nowadays, because there weren't any road signs, and there weren't any road numbers. In fact, there weren't any roads a lot of the time. So it wouldn't be any use having an AA map of the time. What you did was you went to the first town, you had a list of towns you go to, so you ask your way and somebody will either show you and be your guide, or they'll tell you how to get there. They even actually started having really quite sophisticated maps. The people who were sailing had things like this called Portland charts, which were quite sophisticated charts for sailors. And they're usually on hide, because of course they were out in all sorts of weather. And they usually got a bit, not many of them survived, because they all got a bit torn up, presumably, because they were, it's a hard life at sea. But you can see this chart here, I don't know whether you can see it, but there's Britain there, and there's the north, there's France, the coastline, coming down here, Spain here, and there's the Mediterranean. And it's not a bad thing of the Mediterranean. There's Sicily, there's Italy down here, and there's Corsica, I think it is. It's not a bad, and this is North Africa here, and the Straits of Gibraltar just there. It's a pretty accurate account of the coastline. And of course they needed that. I think they were probably kept secret because they were tools of the trade. You didn't want everybody to get hold of them. So there were maps in those days. Now, of course, we always think now that, well, science, they weren't really science. There was no such thing as science in the Middle Ages. And science didn't really start until Isaac Newton. And Isaac Newton, of course, he came up with the theory of the colour and light, and that white and light would actually be split into all the colours of the rainbow. I love this picture of him here, the young Newton, going, seeing this bubble, the child's bubble, and suddenly going, oh, yes, I've got it, I've got the idea. Just expressed in the hand here, and his hand on his paperwork there. Now, the only thing wrong with this account of science is that Roger Bacon in the 13th century had already described exactly what Newton described. He'd said that white light splits up into the different colours. So why doesn't Bacon get the credit for this? Well, I suppose Bacon doesn't get the credit for this because, he was a medieval man, and he was an alchemist, of course. He was an alchemist who spent his time trying to turn lead into gold, and nobody can take that kind of person seriously. And of course, alchemists lived in a state of absolute chaos and didn't know what they were doing. Now, the only snag about this is that Isaac Newton was also an alchemist. he spent more time on alchemy than he did on describing the properties of light. And the rest of the time he spent trying to work out the Book of Revelations. Nobody sort of rubbishes Isaac Newton. I think that's because he had the one great advantage over Roger Bacon, and that was that he wasn't living in the Middle Ages, so everybody could take him seriously. The pursuit of knowledge was going on all the way through the Middle Ages, but in a way they were interested in different kinds of things from what we're interested in now. But they were doing also technical things as well. I mean, they were mainly interested in things of the spirit and things like that. So that's where a lot of their pursuit of knowledge went. But they were also interested in practical things. In 1327, Richard of Wallingford, who was the abbot of St. Albans, designed and probably built a mechanical clock. And this was quite a clock, because it had a 17-and-a-half-year cycle. And it was an astronomical clock that not only told you the time of the day, but also the position of the stars, and it followed the movements of the moon and in its 17-year cycle. So it's a pretty sophisticated kind of computer. And also when we think about the Middle Ages being so sort of, sort of ignorant about technology, I mean, what about their building? I mean, it's like one of just forgets those amazing cathedrals. I mean, we couldn't build them now. They were amazing technical achievements, and the people who built them were actually working at the actual boundaries of their technology. And we know they were working at the boundaries of their technology because a lot of the time they fell down. The
The Tower of Winchester Cathedral fell down in 1107. Gloucester Abbey, the tower fell down in 1170. Lincoln Cathedral, the nave collapsed in 1185. And I think there was a service going on at the time. St. David's the day. Well, there was a lot of buildings falling down throughout the period. But in a way, is that any different from, for instance, you know, the development of flight? You know, the people were trying to make planes work, and you just have to do it by trial and error to see how you're going. I don't see the difference. I think they were just doing exactly what we do today in exploring the boundaries of technology.
35W3.
Ah, that's a good point. Do you know, it just occurred to me before you said it. It's a huge gap missing, isn't it? It's just, God, looks awful. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. I thought maybe I should skip over this bit, actually. but building was also the, you know, it was seen as the, you know, here's these angels sort of beating down the Tower of Babel. It's people's pride trying to take buildings too high. Now, one of our other misconceptions about the Middle Ages is the age of chivalry. The thought of these knights in armour riding around rescuing maidens in distress from dragons and things like that. I mean, you know, how did they live? You know, how did they get their money? You know, what did they do? In fact, actually, knighthood is a cult of violence. It's a cult of doing nasty things to other people. And that's the whole basis of it. I particularly dislike this one. He's got this sort of awl here where he's taking this guy's eye out. And it's really horrible, isn't it? They didn't stand, particularly like this one. They've got this catapult and they're throwing the heads of slain people back at the other. And I think the people in there were throwing their heads back again. Well, the trouble with the whole cult of violence is that it was getting out of hand. Young men were full of testosterone, were all looking for you know, trouble. I mean, talk about sort of lager louts and bother boys nowadays. It was going on in the Middle Ages as well. And that, in a way, is why the Pope, Urban II, declared the First Crusade in 1095. He saw the Crusade as a way of these knights letting off steam. So he sort of got them all together and said, look, why don't you go and kill the infidel and stop killing each other? Now, this was quite a break, because for the first time in Christianity, killing had always been forbidden in Christianity. But for the first time, the church gave people permission to kill. And the idea was that it was all right to kill if you were killing Muslims and if you were on a crusade. And this was really quite a turn-up in the way things looked. But the knights were always looking for some sort of gloss of respectability. And you've got sort of books of orders of chivalry laying down a code of behaviour. There's always this constant... The secular people were trying to give guides how to curb the knights' violence. There were other ways of curbing the knights' violence. They instituted sort of orders of chivalry, like the Order of the Garter. This is the chapel at Windsor. And these were basically a great chance to dress up, basically. So it was all a way of trying to give a moral justification to the violence, but to actually make it seem more palatable. And of course, the knights loved dressing up and having tournaments. That was a very key part in breaking your lance and unseating your opponent, and then of course winning the prize. And I like this, that here's the lady bringing the prize, and I suppose this guy's going to get it. And he's saying, "Oh no, I couldn't possibly. No, not me." but the reality behind this all the trappings of chivalry was quite different. Here's the Black Prince, who was regarded as being one of the great exponents of chivalry. And there's his father, Edward III. And the Black Prince would ride into battle in full costume. Here he is at the Battle of Najira in 1367. And I don't know whether you can see him. There he is there. And he was regarded as the sort of apex of chivalry. But there's a little story about something that happened at Limoges. The Black Prince had been a bit pissed off with the inhabitants of Limoges because they sided with the other side, and he decided to take it out on them. And so he attacked the city. And during the battle, there were three French knights who were fighting so well back to back, and the English couldn't get stop them, but couldn't bring them down. And they fought all day. And at the end of the day, the English knight said, "That was a jolly good fight. You did really well. And although we captured you, we'll treat you very well." And they went home and had a big feast and had a very nice time. However, the Black Prince was still in a foul mood. He was very ill, actually, at the time. And he just ordered the rest of the army to go in and kill everybody in Limoges. And actually, it was their bishop who'd actually sort of upset him, not the people in Limoges. But sure enough, he went in. The army went in and slaughtered everybody in the city. And that was the kind of reality behind, you know, actually chivalry was all, well, it's all very good, well and good, and there was a code of chivalry, but it was for the toffs. It wasn't for the hoi polloi. Nobody really cared much about what happened to them. And of course, chivalry, it was a lot of sex and violence too. I love these ladies looking from here. Oh, look, he's been cut in half. But this brings us to the whole myth of the damsel. We have this concept of the medieval damsel as this shrinking violet who has to be, who's helpless and can't do anything for herself. Who's sort of hiding behind the tree while the brave knights in shining armour fight it out for her. And she's wondering which one she wants to win. Oh, but she couldn't do anything herself. And Tennyson's poem of the Lady of Shalott, for instance, this is a Victorian painting for it, the lady who should only look at her beloved in the mirror, but here she is, she suddenly turns to look at him, knowing that it'll be the death of her. And this concept of the passive woman is a Victorian concept. It starts coming up through the Renaissance, perhaps, but it's very much a Victorian concept, and it isn't a medieval concept at all. Oh, I like this photo, this one about it's always a nasty job, but somebody's got to do it. But the whole idea of the helpless woman is very much a Victorian idea. In fact, in the Middle Ages, women were regarded as being the more sexually aggressive of the sexes. As in this, he's stopping and putting his where our hands going. There's a record of the Margery, who's Countess of Carrick, who meets Robert Bruce, not Robert the Bruce, but a relative. Robert Bruce in the forest, and fancies him like mad, and carries him off to her castle, and keeps him in the castle for 16 days until he agrees to marry her. it's not the kind of thing you expect. Women were. This is a Boccaccio story. Oh, by the way, these pictures, medieval pictures, very often they're like strip cartoons. They're not just one event. They're usually, like this one here is divided by this pillar. So that's one event going on there. And then there's another event in the story going on there. So it's like the compartments in a cartoon. And the story of this is that Philippa here, she's making love to her lover here, and she's surprised by her husband. Whoa! And by the way, she's looking over his lover's shoulder saying, "Don't look now, but so look who's walked in the door." she then goes, taking place in Prato, and a city in Italy, and at this time, women who were taken in adultery were to be executed. So she goes. Insists on going and pleading her case before the magistrate. And everybody says, no, defence, don't do that. You know, just keep it quiet. But she insists on going to the magistrate and pleading the case. And the aggrieved husband brings her there. And she says to the judge, ask my husband if I've ever refused him his due in bed. And the husband says, no, she never has. It's absolutely true. It is true. And so then Philippa says, so what am I going to do with the rest? Give it to the dogs? there's a terrible story about poor old Walter de Font, who is down in the records as not being able to perform his marital duties. And in those days, it was in Britain, it was quite legitimate for the wife, if her husband couldn't perform, to actually she'd get a divorce for that reason. Poor Walter de Font, there's the account in the court records saying how he was inspected by 12 good women and true of the village, who all inspected his member and agreed that he couldn't do anything with it. And one of the good women and true actually warmed her hands on the fire and then tried to bring him to life, but still couldn't do anything. What a way to enter history, isn't it? What a way to go down in history. poor Walter de Font. Anyway. Dr. Sam Riches, Samantha Riches, has recently made a study of pictures in the Renaissance of St. George and the dragon, St. George killing the dragon. And she's come up with a rather startling theory. And things were changing in the Renaissance. Women in the Middle Ages had actually, not all the Middle Ages, but especially towards the end of the 14th century, they'd be getting more and more power, more and more taken into political life as well. But in the Renaissance, that all stopped. And she'd noticed that in a lot of these pictures of St. George here killing the dragon actually has female anatomy. And so what? And she was saying, so what does this mean? It seems like the dragon is actually female sexuality, and that's what the bold knight is killing. And it's men taking power and taking over from women, and not allowing women to have political power. And one way of doing that is to de-sex them, and that is maybe what these pictures are about. And of course, one of the great icons of the Middle Ages, of course, it was Joan of Arc, who was eventually burned as a witch. Actually, she wasn't actually burned as a witch. She was actually burned for wearing men's clothing. rather oddly, because she refused to take it off because she was dressed as a soldier, and she refused to take the men's clothing off because she was afraid of what might happen to her. She was afraid of the prison guards. In fact, the whole thing about witches, when people talk about the Middle Ages, you think about witches, that's when they burned witches. Well, they didn't actually burn witches. In fact, they burned quite a few people, but they didn't necessarily burn witches. In fact, the church actually didn't recognise witchcraft. As far as the church was concerned, all through the Middle Ages, witchcraft didn't exist. And it was only in 1484 when Innocent VIII actually declared that there was such a thing as witchcraft, and that opened the floodgates to the persecution of innocent women as witches. And that carried on through the 16th and 17th centuries. It's a Renaissance thing. It's nothing to do with the Middle Ages, the pursuit and the burning of witches and the horror that went on at that time. Just look at these terrible pictures. Now, this is... I just put this in because I like the stories about the monasteries. Phil put me right, I'm sure, because I've got a lot of things wrong. But the monasteries in the Middle Ages that saw the real start of the medieval monasteries was St. Benedict. who got fed up with Rome because, you know, the life was too good, the women were too beautiful, the food was too good, and the wine was too good. So he got fed up with all that. And he decided to go and live in a cave up on this cliff. And he lived in a cave, I think it's about there, but he's now built this monastery over the cave where he lived. But you can still go in and see the cave there. And every day a friend of his would lower down a basket of food for him to eat. And he lived there for something like 2 years. It was Benedict who wrote the Book of Rules, the Rule of St. Benedict. And this is his book. And then he laid down the rules for being a monk. You should have very simple clothes, just enough to keep you warm. You should live this life of privation. That was the essential thing about being a monk. You had to live a life of simplicity and personal sacrifice and privation. And that, it was believed, gave you a hotline to God, as it were. And people needed this hotline to God. Society was divided into three strata. You had the peasants down below, you had the church, and you had the knights. And the knights in particular needed a hotline to God. Because they were always up to no good. They were always killing people when the church said you shouldn't kill people. In the Battle of Hastings, at the time of the Battle of Hastings in 1066, you had to actually do 40 days penance for every man you killed. If you look at William the Conqueror, he probably killed something like 10. He's probably responsible for 10,000 deaths. That's 1,100 years of penance. He wouldn't be finished till 2,168. He'd still be doing it. So he desperately needed somebody to actually be able to intercede on his behalf. And the monk, that is the service that the monks were providing for the gentry. And you had the Benedictines coming over in the 6th century, the Cluniacs, in the various the Cistercians. They're all providing this service for the gentry. And the gentry were so grateful for this that they repaid them. And so the monasteries got terribly rich. So consequently, that's why you get these waves, because once you've got Benedictines getting extremely rich and well off, people say, well, actually, you're not really leading a life of privation. So then another lot comes along, the Cluniacs, and then they get very rich, and so then the Cistercians come along. And it's a sort of self-annihilating position, in a way. But what about the rules of St. Benedict? Well, you know, if you're in poverty, well, it's, you know, when you've got all this money, it's rather hard to know what to do with it. So you build wonderful buildings like Rivo Abbey here. Of course, St. Benedict also said that you shouldn't eat red meat. You could if you were ill. So what the monks eventually decided to do was, so meat was available in the infirmary, but not in the dining room. So eventually they all ate in the infirmary. you also were supposed to do manual labour, but of course, you know, if you were a choir monk and you were very sort of well-bred and you know, quite rather podgy perhaps because you were eating rather well, you don't want to do manual labour. Good Lord, no. So what they did was they invented a manner of monk called the lay brothers. And the lay brothers were called monks, but they did all the manual labour. So that's the way they got around that rule of St. Benedict's. And of course, you were meant to have silence at meals. The way they got around that was that St. Benedict did say, well, you could make the sign of a sound of a sign. In other words, if you want the salt, you could say, and somebody could do that for you. But of course, what happened was, also he didn't say you couldn't whistle, so you couldn't whistle as well. Of course, the sound of a sign turned into a fully fledged sign language, which they could communicate. So if you went into one of these factories during mealtime, you'd see all the monks siding away like this and whistling, but not speaking. And there's this rather charming picture here of these nuns, and you can actually see they're all using sign language. And these pictures, they often look rather crude, but actually there's always a story in them. There's always more in it than meets the eye. And in this one, you can see what's going on. This girl here is telling her, "Have you heard about so on?" You know, and she's saying, "No, really." And she's saying, "Oh, heaven preserve us!" And it's only this one, it's the only one who's listening to the Bible being read out. Medieval medicine, wow, come on, you know, how can you say anything decent about that? We know people were dying like flies. But on the other hand, there are things you can say in favour of medieval medicine. They put an emphasis on not just the medicine itself, but in the hospital, you were supposed to eat well, they were supposed to provide you with good food, because that was seen as very essential to recovery. Although this guy doesn't look very keen on what he's being brought. I'm not sure. You might think that the theory of the four humours is a very crude theory. You know, it's dividing people up into melancholic, choleric, sanguine, phlegmatic. Well, that's a pretty crude thing to do. But on the other hand, I'd say it's a damn sight better than we have nowadays, where we just treat everybody the same. And you walk into your doctors, and you're just a machine, basically, and you're treated by a mechanic, basically. And I think what the four humours gave practitioners of medicine was the opportunity to assess their patient and see what kind of treatment they might need. I think one of the things that really interests me about looking at the Middle Ages and looking at the past and the history in general is that people don't change. You see the same people seeking power and using power, and often using the same techniques to use it. And this is Thomas Arundel. He was Archbishop of York for many years, and then Archbishop of Canterbury in the time of Richard II. He then got booted out in 1397 and was on his uppers on the continent without a job. And he'd been the most powerful man in England. He really is the Kissinger or the Karl Rove of his time. He was always manipulating behind the scenes and knew exactly how to get things done. And you can see it in his face. He's a very clever, very charismatic, very, very ruthless man. When he's out in his uppers in Europe, he goes to the Pope to try and get a job, but he can't. He was the wealthiest man in England for a long time, but he doesn't get. He can't get anything. He's got nothing. Nothing to look forward to. Henry Bolingbroke, Henry of Derby, is exiled the next year. And part of his terms of exile, when Richard exiles him, is that, and Henry is going to become Henry IV, don't forget, part of his terms of exile is that on no account is he to meet up with, communicate with, or talk to ex-Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Arundel. Richard was really scared of Arundel. But, of course, they did meet up, because Henry was Arundel's one chance to get back into the game and not die forgotten on the continent. And so Arundel comes back with, I'm pretty sure he persuaded Henry to go for the throne, and they come back, and then Arundel throws himself and does anything he can to support Henry. And like people do nowadays, he wants to have a war, so he produces a dodgy dossier. And this is the dodgy dossier. And the dodgy dossier in question is a papal bull that Arundel claimed was the Pope declaring a crusade against Richard II. Of course, it's just made up. He just made it up, but it just really helped to get things moving. And by the time everybody found out that it was made up, well, they were in power, and who cares? And you can see in his audience here, the people sitting there go, really? Do you think he really did go and do that? No, I don't think so. Do. Oh, come on. Arundel was a very clever man. But he was not, when he comes back into power, he's not in absolute control of everything. He needs to cow the population in some way. He needs to create a climate of fear. And so what he does is he declares a war on heresy. It's not very far away from things nowadays. But it just suits him to keep this this climate of fear going on so that he can actually start picking out his enemies and making sure he takes control of everything. And we also see in Richard's reign, we see the same people, the same hawks who are behind war, and they're behind war for very much similar reasons to nowadays. The Duke of Gloucester and the Earl of Warwick here, they're desperate to keep the war with France going because they're both rather poor and they desperately need the money. They make money out of the war. The war is a money-making machine for them. It's impoverishing the rest of the nation. It's destroying France. People are dying. It's a bloodbath, but they make money out of it. The Earl of Arundel actually has plenty of money. And I think he was a hawk just because he was a nasty person. In the 14th century, one of the remarkable things about the military was that they started employing mercenaries on a very large scale. Same thing as happening now. And as is happening now, they found they couldn't control the mercenaries. Because the mercenaries, they're not in there fighting for their king and country or for their honour or anything like that. They're just fighting for the money. And that's the long and short of it. And so when Edward III declared peace with France in 1360 and said, right, okay, stop it, everybody, stop fighting. My lot home, please. And they wouldn't go. But they were having a very nice time. In fact, most of them didn't have any homes to go to. They'd been fighting in France for maybe 20 years. They didn't have anywhere to go, so they just stuck around. And then they started forming themselves into freelance armies. The English and the French, they had been fighting each other, but then they got together and they formed what was called, Froissart calls the Great Company, which he says was 16,000 strong. Well, can you imagine? That's bigger than any national army at the time. And you imagine you're a peasant in France digging away, you know, and you suddenly look up and there's the great company on the horizon. And you know they're not fighting for any principle. I mean, they're just after murdering you, stealing everything, raping your daughter and killing your wife. You know, fine. So it was a terrible time. So even though they declared the peace with France in 1360, throughout the period, to the end of the century, really, the plague of mercenaries destroyed Europe. It seemed like the genie had been let out of the bottle. These marauders, these bandits, were just, you know, they were bandits. They commercialized warfare, and once you commercialize warfare, it's the beginning of the end. They let the genie out of the bottle, and it was a disaster. They didn't know how they could possibly stop it. It was really like the atom bomb. It hanging over everybody. Nobody knew how they were going to stop this dreadful plague of mercenaries. But the thing is, in the Middle Ages, in medieval times, people were just people. You know, they went to bed with the wrong person. This guy's a monk, for instance. He shouldn't be there. They stole things and got sent down for it. Here's the purse he stole. Send him down. And they did silly things. this is a story by Boccaccio about how a judge was laying down the law when somebody under the stage reached up and pulled his underpants down. So they did really silly things. But they weren't less intelligent. The people of the Middle Ages weren't less intelligent than us. They made mistakes. But if we don't learn about the past, if we don't don't read about them, and assert our kinship with them, we're doomed to repeat the mistakes that they made. And so that's why I think looking at the past is so crucial, and the study of the Middle Ages is one part of history. It's all important, but it's a crucial thing, and if we don't do that, we just don't know who we are. We're just blank ciphers walking into the shopping mall, and we don't have a sense of purpose, a sense of destiny. And that's what history gives us, is a sense of destiny. And I think that's something that's absolutely essential. Thank you very much.